Change doesn't wait. Sometimes it storms in, sometimes it creeps quietly, unfolding in ways we notice later. It stirs in boardrooms, classrooms, streets, and communities, wherever people act with purpose. What moves you? A vision? A challenge? A belief in business as a force for good? And what holds you back? External factors or limiting beliefs? I'm Gary Watts, and this is Moved, the podcast of 289 people inspiring change. I'll be speaking with people exploring what first moved them, what they've achieved, and the challenges they've had to overcome, both outside and within. Each episode is about human performance, leadership, sustainability, doing the work that matters, and the moments that change everything. This is Moved. Today, I'm joined by Noemi Roy. Noemi is a consultant haematologist at Oxford University Hospital's NHS Foundation Trust, and she's working on some of the rarest blood disorders, such as sickle cell disease, which is something that strikes some parts of the population more than others. But what stood out to me about Noemi's work is also the way she brings patients into the centre of it, as partners. This is a conversation about listening to patients as partners, uncertainty, and how medicine can care for those who are afflicted by rare disorders where funding can sometimes be a challenge. It's my first health-focused guest, hopefully the first of many. So, Noemi, you're actually guest 17. So when I started this, I was going to do 289 episodes in 17 blocks of 17, and you're guest 17, so you're in what I consider the first chapter.
We finished the first block today.
We are finishing the first chapter, which is fantastic, and I'm really pleased to have you. And when we spoke last time, obviously the intention was to speak with people that relate to, in some way, some of the UN SDGs, and that includes nearly, you know, many people, because the breadth of the UN SDGs is vast, really. And then I realized that I hadn't actually spoken with anyone that directly works in the field of health before. Mm-hmm. And you're the first one, and hopefully the first of many, really, because it's such an important area.
Let's hope so. Mm-hmm, absolutely.
So I guess let's start there then. It would be fascinating to hear really about your work. And I know that you're quite focused specifically on rare blood disorders. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us about that field?
Okay. So I'm a hematologist, which is a doctor who works with blood disorders. And hematology is divided into lots of different parts. So most people, when you talk about hematology, they'll know about the cancer part of hematology. So that would be things like leukemia, lymphoma. Some of these cancers are very aggressive. Some are less aggressive. They're things that people live with and have to manage over many years. And then another part of hematology will be the bleeding and the clotting disorders. So that would be things like hemophilia or blood clots. People will have heard of DVTs and pulmonary embolism, for example. And then you've got another part of hematology that deals with blood transfusions. And then what I do is what we call red cell disorders. So I work on anything to do with red blood cells. So anemia. So anemia means you don't have enough red blood cells. Most people, when they hear the word anemia, they immediately think iron, which is quite a common form of anemia. And something like 30% of the world's population have got iron deficiency at some point. So it really is a huge problem. But I work mostly on inherited anemia. So that would be sickle cell disease, thalassemias, and rare inherited anemias. So these would be conditions that would be like 1 in 50,000 to 1 in a million, very rare conditions.
Okay, very rare. Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of the population size then, or the your kind of patient set that you look at?
So in the UK, we have got registries that are supposed to record every patient with these conditions. And we've got about sort of 17 to 20,000 people with these disorders in total. Mm. The vast majority are sickle cell disease. And then you've got, let's say 17,000 sickle cell disease, a couple thousand with thalassemia, and then a couple thousand with rare anemias.
Yeah. So can you tell us more about then sickle cell disease, what actually it is, and
So sickle cell disease. So it's an inherited anemia. So people are born with it. It's a recessive disorder. That means each parent carries the abnormal gene. Each parent is healthy, so that's being a carrier. People might have heard of carriers like with cystic fibrosis. That's the same type of thing. It's a recessive disorder. Each parent is a carrier. They're healthy and they don't know they've got anything until they have a child who's affected. And there's a 1 in 4 chance of each child being affected. It's more common in populations that there is or there has been malaria. So it's mostly people of Afro-Caribbean origin who have it. And the reason why this gene is around so much in those populations is because the gene itself, the abnormal gene, carries some sort of evolutionary advantage for the carriers. So probably we think that as a population, people who are carriers were less likely to die of severe malaria. So that would make sense why this gene would have been carried on and on generation after generation.
Yeah.
But if you get both of the genes, then you have sickle cell disease. And that's a very serious condition. So in some African countries, many people with sickle cell disease will die before age 5. Mm. And they will die of preventable infections. Mm. Whereas in the UK, where we pick these up very early, we expect people to live a lot longer.
Mm. Yeah.
So the median survival at the moment is 54, which as a 51-year-old, I think 54 is pretty young.
Yeah, definitely.
But a lot of our patients will have lived their whole childhood and adolescence being told you're not going to live past 20 or 30. So already things are getting better, but they're not good enough.
Yeah. So is what's involved in terms of, I guess, one, identification, and two, treatment? And I guess also related, is there anything in terms of prevention? It sort of sounds maybe, possibly not, but to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of looking after sickle cell disease is preventive medicine. Mm-hmm. The first thing you asked about is detection. So we do in the UK have two programs to detect sickle cell early. One is an antenatal screening program and one is a postnatal screening program. So antenatal, we screen every pregnant woman to check whether she could be a carrier. Mm-hmm. And if she is a carrier, we screen the baby's father to check whether he's a carrier. And then we know if they're both carriers, there's a 1 in 4 chance of the baby being affected. Mm. What I don't like about this program is that what we're offering people is finding out whether they've got an affected child. So that means having an amniocentesis, so like a needle put into the belly, and then finding out whether the baby's affected and then being offered a termination. Mm. So it's not brilliant because we're offering terminations. And for a lot of people, that's not something they would want to do for religious or other reasons.
Yeah.
It's much better if we could do the screening before people get pregnant. Mm. But that's a whole other kettle of fish. It's much more expensive and we're not set up for that. Mm. The postnatal is part of the heel prick testing. So when babies are born at day 5, they all get a little tiny pinprick on their heel, and that goes on a piece of paper, and lots of genetic conditions are tested, and they're all conditions that we can do something about. So there's no point detecting something that we then can't do anything about. So we're detecting people that we could then give some treatment or prevention or whatever. And for sickle cell disease, the prevention at that age is starting preventive antibiotics.
Okay.
And that's because babies and children with sickle cell disease, their spleen stops working. Mm. And the spleen is what protects you against very severe bacterial infections. Mm. So, you know, the meningitis outbreak we've just had in Kent, it's those bacteria. Okay. Mm. So I haven't really said what is wrong with the sickle cells, what's wrong with them. So the mutation is in a gene that codes for the hemoglobin molecule, one of its components. And normally hemoglobin just floats around the red cell. But in sickle cell, it doesn't float. It makes really long strands that stretches out the red blood cell.
Right.
They burst open, so the body has to make more very quickly. So they're always anemic because they can't keep up. But also they block blood vessels. And then bits of tissue die, So they have a lot of very painful episodes. So they call them sickle cell crises. People have to come in with an ambulance, get morphine in hospital. It's absolutely horrible. Very, very painful. But it damages organs as well. So it damages your spleen, so it stops working. It damages your kidneys. It can damage your eyes. It can damage your bones. It can damage lots of different organs.
Yeah, yeah. Serious. What are your success stories from a patient point of view? What's the things you've been able to like really make a difference on?
So I think in the UK, what our successes are is the detection, so that we pick up people early, and we've got a lot of really good, well-organized centres, so that even if the patients are not living in a centre, that there's experts. There's a system set up so that they have access to experts. And people are able to access essentially the right way of being looked after. A lot of that isn't very technological. It's, you know, it's really keeping on top of blood results, making sure people have had all their vaccines, making sure people are going to their eye appointments. So it sounds really boring. It's not, you know, we're not saving lives by bringing helicopters and cutting people out of cars, but we're saving lives by making sure people have had their vaccines, basically. Personally, in terms of what I think I'm good at, is really listening to patients and really making sure that patients really understand their condition, understand why we're suggesting what we're suggesting. It's not enough to say, you need to go to your eye appointment, if a patient doesn't understand what we want to pick up. So I use a lot of visual cues. I print out pictures so they can see what would it look like behind my eye if I don't go to these appointments, what might be developing. And then we also really try and push a medication called hydroxycarbamide, which is not very expensive and has got 30 years of track record of how good it is in lengthening life and preventing complications of people with sickle cell disease. And which essentially, if we're thinking about what could we do in other countries to make sure they get good sickle cell care, the detection is a key thing. And then giving people access to preventive antibiotics and preventive appointments, and then hydroxycarbamide. That would be what we need to do.
Yeah, I really want to come on to the global picture shortly, but from a UK perspective, interested, how many patients on average are you working with at any one time, and how many centres do we have across the UK of this sort of expertise?
Yep, so there's 10 highly specialised centres, but the centres are very different. So some centres in London will have 600 to 1,000 patients in their clinic, whereas we have about 100 in our clinic. However, we've got 500 in our region, so the way we organise our care has to be different from the way that the London centres will organise their care. We will go out to each of our regional hospitals and do face-to-face visits with all the patients once a year. They'll be looked after by their general hematologist, but we will go out and do a specialist review once a year with each patient. And for patients, that's really, really beneficial, and they really appreciate speaking to someone who only does this, right?
Yeah. So
these general hematologists, they also can look after all those cancer types of hematology problems, which I can't do. I only do red blood cells. So that's, yeah, that's the number of patients we're dealing with. The other thing that's really difficult is for people who don't know much about sickle cell, it's hard to understand and imagine and believe how much pain people are in. And there's a racism element as well, because these patients are mostly Afro-Caribbean. So you've got black people coming into A&E saying, I've got this disease that most people don't know much about, and I need morphine. And they often get accused of being drug abusers, or they're just, you know, seeking a high from the morphine, and that's not what's happening at all. And so there's appalling stories. It's well worth reading a report called No One's Listening.
No One's Listening.
Yeah, it's from the APPG, the All Party Parliamentary Group on Sickle Cell Disease. It was published about 3 years ago, and it's a dreadful list of all the failings that have been going on all around the UK that have led to avoidable deaths of people with sickle cell disease whose pain has not been taken seriously and whose condition has not been taken seriously. So a large part of what we do in our expert centers is teaching. It's very hard to teach in A&E because if you think about the number of admissions to A&E, and then the sickle cell will be tiny proportion, and A&E doctors tend to change every 3 months. So even if you went in every 3 months to do the teaching, you know, what's the chance that then the people you've just taught will see a patient with sickle cell disease and will have had your teaching? It's quite difficult.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Interested when our understanding, obviously the picture is always forming and we're learning, you know, like you say, learning more, and there's an education thing in various, and the rarity makes it difficult as well. But when did this first be understood as a disease, sickle cell? When was it first identified, and almost how the understanding of it has grown over time?
Yeah, so it's a long time ago. I don't know the dates off off the top of my head, but I think 1910 was when it was first, the gene was first linked to the disease. But basically, it was initially identified in a student from Granada at one of the hospitals in the US. And somebody saw down the microscope these funny little cells that red blood cells should be round, but instead they were banana-shaped, sickle-shaped. We've known about it for a long time, but there's not been much interest in it. Again, that's an element of racism and, oh, this is a disease of black people. Why should we be spending money on it, essentially? If you think about cystic fibrosis, which is equivalent because it's also recessive, it's also a rare disease. It's been shown several times that there's something like 7 times more money gets spent on cystic fibrosis research compared to sickle cell research, which is absolutely shocking. So I think we're trying now to do more advocacy. There's been more in the news about this condition. But there's been no new drugs for a long, long time. There's been a few drugs that have come to market and been removed because of different findings from clinical trials. And now, I don't know if you want to get onto this, but we also have gene therapy, which we can talk about.
Yeah, I would definitely love to come on to that. Before we go there, just interested, because I'm guessing your purview is mainly from a UK perspective, but to the extent, you know, to understand more about the picture globally, you mentioned like the rarity like here, but I'm guessing there's parts of the world that maybe malaria is more common, where it's more prevalent, and just what that global picture looks like a little bit more.
Yeah, so the vast majority of people with sickle cell disease are in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. There's a lovely picture in one of the publications about epidemiology that has drawn the map of the world with the size of the country relative to how many sickle cell patients we have, or they have. And Ghana and Nigeria are really big on there. India is actually really big on there as well. The UK is a tiny little line, so it's really minuscule compared to sub-Saharan Africa. And in those countries, there is, for the general population, unless people are very well off and have access to some private healthcare, they're not picked up as having sickle cell disease. Now, we're having a lot more people coming from those countries to work in the UK. So at the moment with visas, people have work visas to come and work in the NHS. And we're having a lot of nurses or healthcare assistants coming from Nigeria in particular, and they have sickle cell disease. And a lot of them either never knew they had sickle cell, they were told they had rheumatism, or they didn't, or they were told they had growing pains. And of course, when the climate in Africa is warmer, they have fewer crises. Then they come in the UK, hit by the cold and the damp, and then they get more crises. So for them, it's quite a shock to get these diagnoses.
Yeah, because it's kind of late. What's the, you know, what would be the typical age that you start to realize there's more of an issue
if you it's haven't extremely if you variable aware. Yeah, it's is extremely it? variable, and that's one of the things about sickle cell disease is some people will have a stroke. So the top age for having a stroke is between 2 and 7 years old. Tiny. Exactly. So you could have somebody has a stroke at the age of 2 and somebody else wouldn't find out they've got sickle cell until they're 30. So it's, you know, hugely variable. Most people would have some pains as they're growing in childhood and adulthood. And then there's whole issues around pregnancy as well. So we have quite a few patients who are completely fine until they're pregnant, and that puts an extra strain on their body. And then they start to have problems.
Mm. Yeah. Are there any countries that you'd say that's an exemplar country in terms of the progress they're making, you know, relative to the UK?
It's a good question. certainly in the US, they started having these comprehensive care centers earlier than us, and they passed some laws about having to have these centers for people to look after people. In Europe, I don't think that sickle cell care is better elsewhere than in the UK. So we do work with our European partners to try and spread, you know, good practice, etc. But I think we're pretty good in the UK, and even then, we're not perfect for sure.
Yeah. So tell me about the gene therapy that you mentioned. That area.
Yeah, it sounds great.
Yeah.
So, especially to patients when they hear about it and they hear about there's a cure, it's gene therapy. Now, before gene therapy, the only cure we had, now some people don't like to call them cures, but the only sort of curative treatment we had was bone marrow transplantation. So that means you take out the patient's bone marrow, you give them chemo basically to empty their bone marrow, and then you give them bone marrow from somebody else who doesn't have sickle cell disease, and you let that bone marrow take over, the stem cells take over and populate the bone marrow, and then they start to make blood that doesn't have sickle cell disease. We've been able to do that for a long time, for lots of different conditions, for malignant conditions, etc. We've been doing it for quite a while for thalassemia. So thalassemia is very similar to sickle cell in the sense that it's a genetic anemia. It's also inherited as a recessive disorder, but it's a bit clearer from a very early age. If someone's going to be transfusion dependent their whole life, that becomes obvious in the first year of life. So right. Those children have been offered bone marrow transplants from sibling donors for a long time. We haven't offered it for sickle cell because, as I've said, some people won't run into too many problems. So why go for a very severe treatment if you'll be fine, actually? So in a sense, we've been waiting for people so that we can find out, oh, is something terrible going to happen to them? Yes, something terrible has happened. That means their sickle cell is bad. That means we should do a transplant. But of course, we would ideally have done the transplant before the bad thing had happened, right? So that's why it's been more complicated for sickle cell. And the problem with these transplants is that because you're getting somebody else's bone marrow, you could react against it. So you have to have immunosuppression, and that puts your risk of infections. Gene therapy sounds better because we take out the patient's own bone marrow cells. We fix it. It's not quite true, but let's just say we fix it.
Yeah.
Then we give them the chemo to clear their bone marrow, and then we give them their own cells back that are fixed. So you shouldn't need any immunosuppression because it's your own bone marrow that's come back. So that sounds a lot better. The problems are it's extremely expensive, in the realms of £1 million per patient.
Wow.
Yeah, compared to the realms of 50 to 100,000 for a bone marrow transplant, let's say. So it's much more expensive. It's not been around as long. So if you had to choose between a brand new treatment that sounds better, but not many people have had it, or a tried and tested treatment where we know the risks, some people would prefer the tried and tested treatment. Even though it's more risky, at least you know what you're taking the risk of, because who knows what's going to happen maybe 10 or 20 years down the line to all people had gene therapy. So anyways, at the moment, we've got this available in the UK. There's a slightly complex pathway you have to follow. To be eligible, you have to have at least 2 admissions a year to hospital for the last 2 years. And then there's other criteria. But some people are starting to go through and to be cured from sickle cell disease.
Wow. Yeah, that's incredible. What are the main frontiers of research at the moment?
That's a really good question. And the answer is there's not a lot of research.
There's not.
There's a lot of different types of research. So there's people that are looking at, can we find better ways of dealing with the pain? Can we find better ways of using the medications that we already have? So for example, the hydroxycarbamide initially was used mostly in people with particular types of sickle cell disease, and now it's being used in other types of sickle cell disease. The hydroxycarbamide has got other kind of side effects. So there's some studies like that have been done in Africa to show that if you use it at a low dose, you don't need to do all the monitoring that we do here in the UK. So that gives an opportunity for people who don't have access to the infrastructure we have here to still be able to take some hydroxycarbamide. We can also give blood transfusions. So there's red cell exchange blood transfusions. Most people with a transfusion, if you think of a transfusion, you think of some blood just going in. But an exchange transfusion means we take the bad red cells out and we put the good red cells in.
Yeah.
So instead of having one or two bags going in, you have 7 to 10 bags going in, coming out, going in, coming out. So there's a study that's going to be looking at whether we should give all pregnant women these transfusions to try and improve the outcomes for the mum and the baby during pregnancy.
Interesting.
And then there's some new drugs. There's always new drugs being studied, but the only two that have come close to being available have both been pulled out in the last few years because of efficacy and safety concerns.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then the gene therapy, do you foresee that the cost of that comes down and subject to, you know, more studies, hopefully the successes don't carry negative implications and that path?
Yeah. So yes, absolutely. For all drugs, all new drugs, the more competition there is, the more the costs come down. My feeling is, I feel like we could do a lot more, a lot better for a lot of patients if that amount of money was poured into the whole system.
I see.
And if that money was well spent, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
And that's where I have an issue partly with the gene therapy and this approach. There's also, for me, there's also a lot of issues around fairness and equity of access to money in the health service. So we spend a lot of money on cancer drugs, and obviously they're important, but some of the cancer drugs will be tens of thousands of pounds to give people an extra 6 months of life, which of course that 6 months of life is going to be hugely beneficial to that person and their family. But is that fair if someone's in their 70s and 80s compared to someone who's in their 20s with sickle cell disease, and that amount of money could give them access to a specialist nurse, a psychologist, all these things that are going to make a huge difference to their life for many more years. And maybe, you know, if you think about it economically, even, you know, they'll be able to go back to work and be able to be a productive member of society. So I've got a lot of issues around, obviously, you know, I follow all the rules, and if my patients are eligible for a gene therapy and they're interested, of course, I make all the referrals.
Yeah.
But I do think there's a bigger question around equity of access to money in the NHS and how that money is distributed to the population. And I feel that the sickle cell population is really disadvantaged here. And sorry, I'll give you one more example. Prescription charges, which are like £9 or £10 now per drug per month. If you have an inherited condition like type 1 diabetes or cystic fibrosis, we talked about, or some of the thyroid conditions, you don't pay these prescription charges. Okay, so
okay.
No children pay them anyways, but as soon as you get into adulthood, you don't pay prescription charges if you've got these conditions. Sickle cell disease, you do. And the only difference between sickle cell disease and cystic fibrosis is the race element. And you know, the sickle cell doctors, the sickle cell patients, the charities have done numerous applications to Parliament and what's it called, you know, when you have to sign a petition.
Yeah.
And it's never been overturned. We always told there isn't enough money for that. Why not? Why is there money for some other things, but not for our patients to not have to pay prescription charges?
Yeah, that one sounds like a difficult one to defend. Like the first thing you mentioned, I kind of get that it's really complex and there's so many trades, there's finite resources and money, and it must be really, I can't imagine really how you kind of choose this over the other and so on. But in terms of that one, yeah, like you'd think.
It's a no-brainer, right?
Yeah, it would do. But yeah, I think it would be good to circle back onto like health justice a little bit more as we go on. But it's such important work that you're doing. And I'm intrigued, actually, like what was your entry point to what is, I guess, in some ways quite a niche field? Like, how did you get involved in this?
I think it was really chance. So when I started my training in hematology, so medicine, you obviously do your medical school training. There's a lot in the news at the moment about doctors that don't get training posts after they finish their training. Back when I was a student, that wasn't a problem. So came out of my medical school, did my first year of training, and then straight on to non-specialist training. So we do a little bit of lots of different specialties, just so we've got experience in different things. And then when I started my hematology training, it's quite funny because normally the jobs go from August to August. That's when people move jobs. And I had started in April for some reason. So there was a little bit of a gap before my proper job started. And they put me in the red cell team at the hospital where I got a job, which is at UCH. And they put me there because there was a maternity cover. Okay, so that means that the registrar at the time, who'd gone off on maternity leave, red cells is always at the bottom of the queue. So if there's a gap anywhere, they always take away the trainee from the red cell team. Okay, so that's the team that has the most gaps. And so of course I came along and they're like, oh, we can fill the gap. So they put me in that team because that's where they had put the gap. And I was really inspired by the consultant who was looking after these patients and the team. And I could see quickly that there's a lot of good you can do just by doing things properly and just by caring. So it's not about technology and fancy things and expensive drugs. Now we have expensive gene therapy, but at the time I could see that it's really about listening properly, putting things in place properly, following up, making sure that people are accessing what they have the right to access and understand why they should access it. And that's kind of what drew me to it. And essentially, it's a disenfranchised population, and I felt that it could have a positive impact.
Yeah. What have your patients taught you?
Very, very good question. And that does not end. So certainly how to listen better. And the idea that you really have to build trust with the patient. And even when you think you've got a good amount of trust, and that they understand you and why you're suggesting what you're suggesting to them, you still have an opportunity to listen again and to listen better, because there are some hard things to hear about why they can't or they won't do what you suggest. So I'll give you two quick examples. One is about culture, understanding people's cultures. Okay, so we're used to, so we call it transition when kids come through, they're finished with pediatrics and they come on to adults. So we've got a good system in the UK. It's called Ready, Steady, Go. And it's supposed to be a gradual transition so that even when they're in pediatrics, they start to meet the adult team. And then once they transition to the adult team, the pediatric team keep in touch for a bit so that it feels like a, you know, seamless process. And one of the things we do as adult hematologists is we like to get the parents out of the room so that we feel that we've got the young adult with us and that they're making their own decisions. However, I feel I learned quite late on that for some people, that really doesn't work. And so one patient in particular was talking about how for her and her culture, they make decisions as a family. There's no such thing as this is me, this is my decision, you can't tell me what to do, which is a very, you know, Western, British, whatever, kind of, you know, you're of age, you make your own decisions, that's it. And so what I thought that was doing well by excluding the parents actually didn't work for either the parent or the child. Now, obviously, sometimes, you know, you can see a parent is answering all the questions for the child and that the child doesn't get the opportunity to say anything. So I'm not saying you should never leave the parents out of the room, but it opened my eyes to the fact that different people have different ways of making decisions. And for some people, making that decision as a family is the right thing to do. So that's one thing.
Yeah.
The other example I was going to give you is one of the research projects we have. I won't go into the huge detail of it, but essentially we're trying to develop a test that people could do at home to sort of help them decide if their crisis is bad enough to come into hospital. Because sometimes patients can't tell, am I getting worse and I really need to go to hospital, or will I be okay if I stay home another few days and it'll just calm down? And my issue is when people wait too long to come to hospital, they end up coming a bit too late. That means instead of being in for 3 days, I'll be in for 3 weeks because it's so hard to get on top of the pain and all the issues that are happening. So I thought that by having this device at home, people would then be empowered to either stay home a bit longer or come to hospital sooner. And we started discussing this with a group of patients. And one of the patients was really quite upset. And the way she explained it is that this feels like another tool that the medical team are going to use against us. We'll come to A&E saying, I'm in pain. They'll make us pee on this device. It's like a pregnancy test, basically. Mm. And they'll tell us, aha, you're not having a crisis. Go home. Whereas I'll be there trying to advocate for myself to say, I am having a crisis. I do need that morphine. I am in pain. And the only reason that that patient was able to tell me this is because of the trust we had built, because I've known her for quite a while. Mm. But that's quite a brave thing for a patient to say to a doctor who's coming from Oxford University saying, oh, right, we've got this great idea. This is our research project. For the patient to be able to say, no, I don't think this is a good idea because this is the reason. And I found that quite humbling that even when I've known people a long time and I've got a lot of, I feel there's a lot of trust there. It sometimes takes even longer before that trust to be strong enough that the patients can be very honest about why something is not going to work for them.
Yeah. Yeah. You touched on two such important areas there, really. The first one is, I guess, how we can make so many assumptions about different cultures and groups of people. And, you know, we're not all the same. And, you know, we shouldn't make those assumptions. There are differences in different societies across the world. And then the second area, what I heard was around like empathy and the importance of that. And it strikes me that that's maybe one of the areas that, I mean, I don't work in like health, but, you know, you could see health as it's about medicine and vaccines and so on, but also it's about empathy and, like you said, listening, really listening and building up trust. But it sounds, from my understanding, that's one of the areas that has a lot of strain on it because, you know, people are busy, you know, GPs only have a certain amount of time and so on. I'm sure specialists only have a certain amount of time and you need to get through the patients. But yet that is, I imagine the patients that have afforded that time to be listened to and understood, that's almost part of the treatment.
Absolutely. And in a way, I don't know the exact details, but I think it's something like 30% of all drugs that are prescribed are not taken, which is completely shocking. And you think, well, what's the point of having that consultation if you're going to end the consultation by giving somebody a prescription and they're never going to take it? So, you know, if only to make sure that people take their treatment, you've got to have that, you know, build that understanding about why it's needed and what might help them take it or not take it. And I think in sickle cell, I was going to come back in a bit about empathy with homeless people, which I'll come back to in a bit. But with sickle cell, this is why we need psychologists as well, but there's a whole, with all chronic conditions, there's a whole kind of psychological thing where if you take your tablets every day, then you're admitting to yourself that you have an illness because you're taking all these. People who are well don't need to take medicines every day. But if you don't take your medicines, you can sort of trick yourself into thinking, actually, I'm fine because I'm not taking any medicines. Now, to you and me, that doesn't make any sense. But when you're a teenager, and it's usually teenagers and young adults, you know, you just want to be like everyone else. You just want a normal life. You're fed up of having all these, you know, barriers to being able to live a normal life. People do get to that zone in their head where they just don't take their medicines because that's the only thing they have control over, or that's the way they can trick themselves into thinking for a bit that they're fine. So then the other thing I was going to say about empathy, so I work one day a week on patient involvement in medical education, which is not really sickle cell, and it's just for the Oxford Medical School, so it's for all conditions, all teaching. And we've done a bit of work with a group of homeless people or people who've experienced homelessness. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. So it's a group of people who are doing some training so that they can then become advocates and they can be consulted by, I don't know, the council or different researchers or medical school, whatever, to give their opinion and about experience of homelessness. And they were talking about the attitudes of paramedics or A&E doctors things they've heard people say about them, like, oh, that so-and-so, yeah, she always comes in here and she's always completely drunk. And, you know, how demeaning it is to have to hear these things being said about you. And at the end of the day, if you're an AE, for whatever reason, you know, nobody needs to be making these assumptions about you just because you live on the streets, or you every time you come, you've drunk too much alcohol. There's
Yeah,
reasons
they're
behind
struggling.
this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, obviously, I don't work in A&E, but I know how busy it is, and that's what you sort of said earlier, is for people to have empathy, they have to have time. You can't have empathy and treat each person with dignity if you have to see twice as many patients as you have time to.
Yeah, exactly. Such a difficult area. Where did you do your training?
I did my training in Edinburgh.
In Edinburgh,
Yeah,
yeah.
so I'm French originally, but I grew up in the US and in Canada and in Belgium, and then I trained in Edinburgh.
Oh, fascinating. Tell me again about your kind of the different countries you were in and when.
So I'm French originally, both my
Yeah.
parents are French, and
Yeah.
we moved
So you grew up
to,
there.
no, so I grew up in near Montreal in Canada,
Okay.
in the
Okay.
French-speaking part of Canada.
Yeah.
I used to have this little Quebecois accent when I spoke when I was little.
Yeah.
And then when I was about 11, we moved to the US,
Yeah.
North Carolina. So I learned English and I started studying in English. And then my dad got a job working for the EU. So we moved to Brussels and I did my
Oh, wow.
European baccalaureate in a European school in the English section. So I continued my education in English. And then I worked in a lab in Paris for a year. And then I started my medical studies in Edinburgh.
In Edinburgh, yeah.
Yeah.
And when was it that you knew that you wanted to go into medicine, and what was the, do you have a sense of what the catalyst for that?
So it's a very embarrassing story. When I was
Okay.
little, I was 4 years old. I remember watching a cartoon of, it was called Candy Candy. It was a Japanese cartoon translated in French, and she was a nurse. She went as a nurse to work on in a war zone, and you know, helping the soldiers and everything. And that's what I decided to do. And so for a long time, I thought I would work like in a third world country. Or work with people with poverty. That was kind of, for a long time, I thought that's what I wanted to do. But in the end, I've ended up staying in the UK, working in a very specialized field. But it's kind of interesting that I gravitated towards a group of patients who really are disenfranchised, sort of in terms of a lot of the socioeconomic background of a lot of our patients. And you know, needing that advocacy and the trying to deal with the injustice of not having access to what other services are having. I mean, even like I mentioned psychologists, so as a child with cancer, you have immediate access to child psychology. The parents have immediately all the, you know, parking fees paid for when the parents come to the hospital, etc. But for sickle cell patients, you know, services try and match that, but it's not automatic in the same way that a child with cancer, what a family with a child with cancer would have access to. So yeah, I think that injustice also was what drives me to trying to work with this group of patients.
Yeah. If it's not too sort of grandiose a topic, like what's the kind of, the discourse in the health sphere around health justice and like the vision, I guess
Within the
it's,
UK, you mean,
yeah.
or
Maybe to start within the UK.
It's a good question, and I think, I mean, there's been definitely attempts to end postcode lottery. You know, people often talk about that, and for example, the way that the specialist hemoglobinopathy teams have been set up around the country is an attempt to overcome some of that injustice, that if you live close to a center of excellence, then you have access to better care than if you live further away. The realities are that a lot of what we're supposed to deliver, we can't deliver because we can't access the funding that we're supposed to, etc. And that's because of the big picture of the NHS being in such dire straits. I haven't heard anybody talk about whether as a society we should be choosing what to spend the money on. Obviously, we've got the National Institute for Clinical and Health Excellence, which decides which drugs are value for money, but those are not compared, right? So NICE will look at a new drug or a new therapy or whatever and say, is this value for money for this patient group compared to what's available for this patient group? But no one is ever asking us as a society to think, should we spend less on cancer drugs and more on smoking cessation, or should we spend less? You know, those things are not discussed at all. Within departments, I suppose there is a little bit of that. So the medical hematology, which is the sort of not cancer side, we used to call it non-malignant hematology, but it's still quite, they're still quite bad diseases. They're malignant in the sense that they're very destructive, right? So we don't use that anymore. But on the medical hematology side, I think those teams within the bigger hematology departments will be trying to get equity with their cancer colleagues. And a lot of the cancer therapies, you know, if you do a lot of clinical trials, that brings money into the department. Right? So the drug companies will pay money for a particular patient to be treated with their drug. And some of that money will actually feed into the department to then be able to employ more nurses or whatever. We don't bring in any money. None of our trials bring money in for our conditions. So there's always that kind of people trying to fight for equity in that sense. But I don't think there is on a societal level. No. I've not heard it.
Interesting. And you're involved in a charity as well, aren't you?
Yes.
Can you tell us more about that?
So I started a charity probably 10 years ago now called Congenital Anemia Network, which is a mouthful, but I thought that it would have a nice acronym, which is CAN. Yes, we can. And it's for people with rare anemia. So the idea was for people for whom there is no charity. So people with congenital dyserythropoietic anemia, pyruvate kinase deficiency, things like that. So very rare anemias. We started in Oxford because that's where I live. And it turns out that sickle cell disease, even though they're not rare compared to the other patients, there's no charity for them in Oxford either. There is a sickle cell society in London, but they don't do very much outside London. So we actually have a lot of sickle cell patients in our charity as well, and thalassemia. And we do an annual event for families to meet each other. And it's been absolutely wonderful. It's gone from strength to strength. The first year, I think we had 20 people. Now we have 120 every year.
Amazing. It's together we can this, isn't it?
Yeah. And we have, and there's, you know, friendships that have been built there and, you know, peer support, which is really important. And for me, one of the most moving things I've ever had was a parent of a young girl. She's much more grown up now, but she was very little. And of course, when a parent finds out that their child has this condition, they're very scared for that child's future. And they're very worried about how long they will live. You know, will they have to go through these painful episodes? And so there's a lot of fear around that child's life. And coming to this event, she met three young women who had careers. I think a couple had a partner, but she for the first time, this mother could see that her two-year-old girl had a future to be an adult and to live a fulfilling life. And she wrote to us afterwards to say that it completely changed how she saw her daughter's future. And I think that's incredibly powerful. And that's not come from me telling her, oh, don't worry, you know, there are good opportunities for your daughter in the future. It's from her meeting people. And so I think that peer support is incredibly important. And like we were saying earlier, empathy is an important part of the treatment. Peer support is an important part of the treatment as well.
Yeah, definitely. I guess it sounds like that's one of the main things that can change for a person, for a patient or their family, is that they can have a more positive future.
Yeah.
Whether it's through treatment or the peer support or the...
And the whole thing. I think what I find difficult from the point of view of running a charity is you kind of think, right, I've set up this charity now. I just wish the patients could run it, right? Could organize things.
yeah.
But if you think about it as a patient, you have to deal with either your own health issues or your child's. But the impact on the rest of your life. So, you know, whether it's the impact on siblings or the impact on, you know, even if it's just you as an adult, when you're not well, you can't do any of the things you want to do. You've let people down all the time. You keep canceling things. So then when you're well, you're not going to go, oh, I know what I'll do. I'll go and help at the charity. No, when you're well, you're like catching up on all the people whose birthdays you missed and all that. So it's a big ask. And I'm always so humbled by my patients, by everything they manage to do. Not everybody manages to have a job, study and all of that, but those who don't, the obstacles they're facing are sometimes, you know, I don't think you or me would manage in their condition, right? And those who do, you just think, gosh, they're dealing with all the same pressures I'm dealing with as a full-time mom, you know, working, having my children, all that. And they have to deal with their health condition. It's so humbling. Mm.
So when did you start the charity Together We Can?
I think it was 10 years ago.
10 years ago. And when did the event start, and, you know, where were the events that you have?
We call it the Family Day. I have to go back and check, but I think this is our like 10th or 11th one that we're doing this year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And do you rotate where they are in the country, or is it?
No, we do them all in Oxford. Yeah. We have done two patient conferences in Leeds. Mm. So the Family Day is for any of the diagnoses. The conferences are for congenital dyserythropoietic anemia. We have maybe 7 people and families coming to that. We did that for 2 years, and that's much more focused on the research and sort of also a lot of peer support and dealing with symptoms, dealing with fatigue, things like that. We are keen as a charity to get involved in other places, but we need people to organize things. Like, we're happy to pay for a family day in Birmingham, but somebody needs to organize it there. So it's more that kind of, we did for 2 years in a row, we had 50 sickle cell patients that came from Wales in these big coaches, because one of the specialist nurses there organized it and rented the coaches, and these people just arrived in Oxford. Mm. It was most wonderful, and our patients loved meeting the patients from Wales. But the last couple of years, they've lost their funding for the specialist nurse, so they haven't got somebody physically there to organize it. Even if we say, well, we'll pay for the coach, we haven't got anyone on the ground that can organize it.
Mm. Yeah. Tell me about you as a person outside of work then. You know, what other things do you do, or are you interested in?
I don't have a lot of time outside of work.
You're very busy.
Obviously, so I've got a family, I've got a daughter who's at university, I've got a foster teenager who's doing an art foundation course, I've got a soon-to-be 15-year-old who is still with me at home, I've got a husband who travels a lot for his work, but also has built lots of magical places to stay that we rent out where we live, which is where we hold the event every year. My own family is spread all over the world. So my parents live in France, and my sisters live, one's in Scotland, one's in New York, and one's in California. So, you know, we do spend a bit of time trying to meet up with each other. And in terms of hobbies, I love crafts. I love doing sort of painting, crochet. I'm not good at anything. I just like doing it. It's very relaxing. And I like walking. I just love the outdoors and walking. Yeah. So that's what I like to do.
Yeah. Walking is definitely good for your health in the outdoors, isn't it? Yeah. What wonderful conversation. It's such a fascinating area. What would you, when you look ahead, what do you hope that your work entails over the coming years? And actually, more generally, what would you like to see over the coming years?
So I think over the coming years, I mean, we've got some very specific local pressures in our hospital with our current financial situation for the hospital, which has meant that we've not been able to grow the team as much as we should have, although that's being released a little bit. So there's been huge amount of pressure locally for us to, and our patient population keeps growing. There's a lot of people moving out of London, moving more just a little bit outside of London, and so that feeds into our service. So I'm very keen that we kind of appropriately grow our team so that we can at least continue doing what we've been doing. I think really focusing on education, again, locally, of our own trainees, our own nurses, etc. But there's a really good, I think there's not a lot of red cell consultants around the UK, and we tend to work really well together. So there's a lot of sharing of, like, if somebody's prepared a talk for a particular topic, they're always very happy to share it. We're trying to use technology a little bit better so that everything's kind of held in one place and everybody can access it. So that kind of, I think, you know, we could do a little bit better with that so that we can sort of build on each other's strengths a little bit more. I'm very keen that we just grow that sort of peer leadership amongst the patients so that certainly the ones that can see the benefit of, for example, starting hydroxycarbamide can really help and encourage the ones that are struggling to see the point of that and to see why it makes a difference. And I think we do a little bit of that, but we haven't got a lot of capacity. So our specialist nurses do put new patients in contact with previous patients to talk to them. But I feel like we could build on that more. Nationally, I think we're going from strength to strength. And then from the charity's point of view, I think it would be nice if we could do a little bit more around other places than just the work that we do in Oxford.
Yeah. Going from strength to strength, I'm glad to hear it.
Hope so.
Is there anything I've not asked you that you think I should have asked you or you wish I've asked you?
We talked a little bit about what's happening in other countries and yeah. We haven't really gone into it a lot. And one thing that's for sure is that some of the big organizations are trying to do that. So, for example, the American Society of Hematology have got lots of projects to try and set up some of that newborn screening in some of the African countries. The British Society of Hematology and the European Hematology Association they've also been trying really hard to have more of a focus on sickle cell and having that sort of more global look as well. The European Hematology Association is particularly keen in expanding knowledge in other parts of Europe that are less strong, so more of Eastern Europe. So and they also run sort of conferences in other parts of the world. So there's been one I've been to one in Egypt, I've been to one in Thailand. So I think these organizations are taking sort of some responsibility for bringing guidelines and teaching and access to research to other places. And it always feels like it's not enough, isn't it? But everything we do, we feel we could do more of and better of.
But you're pushing to make a difference for your patients in the UK and these organizations trying to do that.
My focus is more local for sure.
Yeah, but other organizations are looking at for that globally. Is your final thought you'd like to leave with listeners?
I think my final thought would be about medicine in general, which is really that idea of seeing your patient as a partner. And I know we have moved along a lot in terms of we are a lot less paternalistic than we used to be, but we keep coming across again and again people that feel they're not being listened to. And although, yes, time, having enough time is an issue, even with the time you have, I think there's a lot we can all do in the way we listen, in the way we speak, that can make a big difference to patients.
Yeah, having your patient as a partner.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. No, Amy, thank you so much. It was a lovely conversation. Really fascinating to learn about this.
Thank you, Gary. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of Moved. If it sparks something for you, subscribe and share it with someone who's looking to make a difference. I'm Gary Watts, and I'll see you next time as we explore what moves people and ideas forward.